Hello, and welcome to Muse and Metrics. This is your host, Philippa Burgess. This is Season 5, Episode 8, and today's topic is the whole picture.
My name is Lisa. I am a data engineer and formerly data analyst and Women Techmakers Ambassador. I have been in the field for probably about 3 to 4 years now, leading communities for about 7 since I was kind of in university. I got my start in bioinformatics, working in academia, and eventually I really got interested in data pipelines. And from there, I've been working a lot through different contracts, consultancies, and startup. And that's kind of where I stand right now. I also chair a local organization called the Vancouver Data Jam. I'm from BC, Canada. And yeah. So my undergrad is actually in psychology. So it's nothing to do with data or science, or really like computer science. And when I was young and a research assistant, I really wanted to do wet lab stuff. So I was, you know, wanting to learn like different histology protocols. I was learning different essays. And I realized that there was a divide happening between the people in fields who are not necessarily aligned with data, taking advantage of data, because research is really data-based. It's all about collecting data and correct data and analyzing it. And what you find in a lot of these more old school, more traditional fields is that they're not necessarily up to date when it comes to data practices. It's a platform that they're dependent on. It's something that's kind of a chore. And I kind of noticed as I was moving through this field that, hey, why wait until a graduate student teaches me these different protocols? And maybe the trajectory of my career is dependent on their sort of charity, when I can learn these skills on my own and I can actually become very valuable as a, you know, part of the lab, as part of this. And so what I ended up doing was joining Our Ladies, which was my local group at the time, and teaching myself R, because it is a very like, you know, academic language for statistics, and learning these different skills. And through there, it was just sort of like, hey, I heard that you can do data. Can you help me analyze this? Can you write a script for this? I need to make this reproducible for a publication. And from there, it just started steamrolling. And some of the points that I thought you brought up were so interesting as well, because I think that we're in this weird brain drain sort of stage in careers where not necessarily like a data scientist within a specific field exists right now. Maybe it does, but only for a data specific company. But what we're seeing instead is a lot of really smart people then reskilling into data and tech and creating brain drain out of these fields, when really what they need is to stay in them to reintroduce data and reintroduce technology in a new and really advocated way. But we're not really seeing that, which is unfortunate.
I love what you say about bring it back to your field, whatever your field is. That's what I noticed was that, and that's how I feel about, like, I feel like there are a lot of jobs right now that are like you said, data analyst, data, but I feel like in the future, it's going to be much more blended. Just like, for example, social media, you have a social media manager, and there are people that's entirely what they do, and they'll even do it for several companies. But within a company, there's a lot of people who do social media where that's not their job title. It just integrated or folded into a marketing role or an admin role.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing right now is a shift from subject matter field experts, where a lot of people spend maybe a decade in one career, to a shift to intersections. So what are you the intersection of, and what has your life really built you to becoming? And what is that unique brand? Especially now, people are learning to brand themselves in very unique ways. And I think data is a really good conduit for that. And the main reason is because data, as technically proficient as you are, it really is about subject matter expertise. Nobody knows your data better than you. And there's so many different facets of data. And it's not always transferable in a one-to-one way like people think. And, you know, you can ask a recruiter that. I'm sure they've had a lot of headaches with trying to assess somebody's skills in that way. But I've had a similar journey where I think, you know, my really early start, and I spent about 6 years as a caricaturist, believe it or not. And that was kind of how I brought myself through high school and university. It eventually made me a people person. And it made me somebody who was able to read what somebody wanted. And that is actually a skill that has probably helped me more in my field than anything else, right? And learning how to work with people, and then figuring out also the nuance of data as well. That was one of the things that I really loved about coming from a different field like psychology is that you're looking at the brain from different levels. You're looking at it from like a, you know, personality level, from a behavioral level, from a brain circuit level, from the biological level, and then, you know, down to this genetic sense where it's super granular with cellular data that you're then translating into these huge amounts of databases and files. And how do you connect all of that in such a way? And that also has its own intersections. You know, if you go into neuroscience or psychology, everybody has a different blend of what that looks like and how they figure out where they sit within that field. And I think data is a tool that we're using to now communicate our expertise, right? And that expertise is nuanced. It is complicated, but it's also appropriate for the world that we're living in now. This is a data journey that, you know, the entire field has gone through, especially as data professionals, but also as businesses have gone through as well, where we generally looked for trends and yes or no answers. If you've ever been somebody who's had to interface with a stakeholder, you know that they just want something quick, yes or no, is this what I need to do or not? What does this say? But really, data and actual proficient data science and statistics is about describing granularity and describing nuance. And I think once you're deep in the data, you're starting to understand those relationships more. And unfortunately, this is something that kind of still lives in academia, but hasn't quite made its way into industry because we're still looking for really quick, you know, black and white answers, you know, quick demographics to kind of be the end all be all. And it's unfortunate because I think that once we understand nuance a lot more, we start to appreciate things like intersectionality. And this is something that, weirdly enough, feminism has gotten really pat down way before, you know, anybody else did, which is that depending on the different facets of your life, depending on your life history, depending on your demographics, you're going to have a unique experience. And yes, there may be general trends that follow along that, but there's also really valuable information and granularity there that isn't necessarily described when you're looking at data from a very simplistic perspective, right? And how can we find the right middle ground of that where, you know, our data analysis is still meaningful in some ways, but it still really is what we consider accurate? Well, that's one of the really big issues with big data as well. And it's odd because I just talked about not necessarily looking at data in a granular enough way, but organizations these days kind of fit into one of two bins, and we're seeing them fit into the second bin more and more now as they're trying to become data-driven organizations where at first people had a lot of survey data and that was really limited. It was a small sample size. And now everything is collected really discreetly through different tools like online analytics. You know, you have Google Analytics as well, where you have almost this endless amount of granularity and it's still kind of spotty, but you can kind of pull whatever conclusions you want because all of a sudden now you're dealing with big data, right? But oftentimes still missing that subject matter expertise that can act as your sanity check beyond just like actual observability and data quality metrics. I think those are, weirdly enough, two totally different types of governance that you really have to look at in those facets. So yeah, it's really hard to figure out what is the right level to look at. And if you're not a data expert, or even if you are a data expert, but not a subject matter expert, it can be really hard to figure out when to stop and when to go deeper. And then you have this whole product side of it is, you know, what do I need just to get through this meeting? What do I need just to get through this next push?
You know? You mentioned a really great phrase, discreetly collected. And I think that we are the data points, and everything we do, every move we make, every way we use our cell phone has just become this remote sensor that we carry with us all the time. And we hear about so many crimes that are solved because, well, their cell phone pinged from that location. They were there. We can just see on a map where they went, when they were there. And the question is, you know, obviously with law enforcement being able and the courts being able to sort of access some of these records, under what circumstances and what is due process, and yet at the same time they can randomize some of our data to see sort of massive trends of where people are going and what they're doing and what choices they're making and how they're spending their money. And but we are the data, and we oftentimes I always refer to in media that there's two business models. You're either paying for the thing, you're paying for the book, the ticket, the concert, the movie theater, and sometimes it's both, you're being advertised to. And so we often will take the advertising in exchange for it's free, but now sometimes that advertising is in the form of we're collecting your data, and because you want something fast and free, you're saying, yeah, I'll sign up for cookies. I'll sign up for whatever you want to, you know, give me, because I just want access and I want it to be free and I'm willing to contribute my data. But you get into whole other issues now when you get into like HIPAA compliance in hospitals and the medical field. So let's talk about like, yeah, where is this data being sourced from? How accessible is it? Where should the governance be? What are our rights? Or what contract are we kind of making that says, you know, sharing this is in the best interest of society?
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that, because it weirdly enough does circle back to consumer psychology, right? What is something that is immediate and tangible that we can actually weigh the pros and cons of? And what is something that is abstract that we're not necessarily able to keep at the forefront of our mind? And how do we value that? We know data is valuable because we're data scientists, but the average person, I think, doesn't understand how valuable they are as a data point. And in terms of the local ecosystem, I won't go into it too much, but there was a video essay I watched recently about dollar stores and how dollar stores seem like this really immediate, nice thing to have in a community, but they oftentimes are a drain and can actually kill local businesses because they're this immediate gratification. And we're using data right now to really exploit that and to make it so that people don't necessarily care, and we're not presenting that information in a way that is friendly or consumable, right? You're having all these pop-ups on your screen, but you're not necessarily reading what these terms of agreements are. And so in a lot of ways, it's a data literacy thing, but it's also the way that that's communicated and how that awareness is made. But a lot of people still, it's not really relevant in their lives. Like, truth be told, I'm somebody who has 10 different extensions on their computer. I use Linux. I block everything from tracking me. But I've also been on the marketing side of things and trying to get those analytics. I'm like, oh my God, there's so many people, you know, using these blockers and I can't track them. And now my data is all messed up. Which side do you pick at the end of that battle, right? And yes, we believe that governments are doing good with our data and are using it to save children. And I think that's valid. I think that's true. But I also think that it can be used, unfortunately, as this form of control. That's why our data is so valuable. That's why you and I have jobs, you know, and why this is a lucrative field, is because the way that you control consumer behavior oftentimes translates directly into profit. And there's a huge incentive there to keep people in the dark about that. And because, you know, that if they're aware of it and they don't want their data to be collected and there's this huge uproar about it, that kind of makes my job harder in a lot of ways, right? I don't know how to grapple with that. That's a really difficult thing. The way that I've grappled with it is just not to work with marketing data and not to work with consumer data as much. But, you know, a lot of people point to government policy and law, because I think this also applies to a lot of other fields as well, not necessarily data collection. But the government is slow to move, and there's a literacy issue at the top of the chain, right? At the actual like policymaking level. And if they're not able to get caught up on the train, how can you expect that to trickle down to the general population? It's just not something that's worth their time, and it's not something that's going to work well. I think the EU does a really good job of finding that middle ground, you know, depending on which side you take there. But they've been very proactive about it. Not perfect, but it's a start. And we're in that learning curve right now where people are going to figure out the downstream effects of it. But again, because our biology is slow to catch up, because our psychology is slow to catch up, because our government's slow to catch up, it might not necessarily ever come to fruition where people are super aware and passionate about their data rights in the same way that they are other things. That might just actually be a reality that comes to pass, unfortunately. People do tend to ask for forgiveness more easily than they ask for permission. And do we have processes streamlined in place as a society to make people aware of when they're being recorded, of when they're being, you know, collected in that way and when they're being used? And I don't think we do, to be honest. I don't think there's the incentive to build that. And I think that it would be a terrible business model, right? If you were to do a startup around that. But it's needed because it's the right thing to do. In terms of, you know, how technology is used these days, everything can be a camera, everything can be a recording device. And, you know, if you've ever done anything like, you know, working with flipper zeros or any sort of hacking, all you need is, you know, a really simple plastic device, and you can just put whatever you want in it and people will kind of trust it, and you can do whatever you want with that data. And that's been exploited time and time over again in, you know, hospital systems, in, you know, police offices, wherever people are trying to extort other organizations. And it's unfortunate, but we just have a hard time protecting against that. A lot of quick, easy data startups have kind of come to fruition in the past 5 years. And some of them fit very specific niches because it's an easy place for them to just make quick money and then kind of move on. You know, with tech, what we see so often is quick innovation, quick and dirty innovation oftentimes. And there's a beauty in that that you don't see in other fields. And that's something that I think lends itself really well to like intersectional thinkers, if we were to bring it back, right? Where can we find this niche and exploit it and really build something that nobody else has ever seen before? Academia moves really slowly. A lot of, you know, traditional businesses move really slowly, but tech moves quick, and it sometimes moves inefficiently. But there's also something kind of nice about that, where something just needs to work. It doesn't always need to be super, you know, fleshed out in the same way that other places are. And it can kind of stand independently in that weird way. You can kind of do so much with a 5-man team. I love this idea that you've brought on, because one of the things that I love the most about being an engineer is, you know, this DevOps philosophy of blamelessness. You know, how do you figure out the core failing without necessarily having to point fingers and fire 10 people? Like, this is a postmortem, right? And there's so many different inefficiencies when it comes to operations in general and in society that we're not necessarily able to look at in a super objective way and really, you know, figure out the root analysis and cause for. But oftentimes what you find as well is that a lot of those failings are in things that almost can't be helped. I think that there was a lot that was preventative, like within the Hawaii fires, but in other pieces like climate change, you know, that's a communication thing that maybe occurred because so many people lived in silos before, and there wasn't enough communication that was meant to be friendly. One of the things that I've loved seeing rise out in the last 10 years is this idea of science communication being a viable field, right? I think people are starting to really take advantage of that and realize the benefit of it, because, you know, all of that funding that goes into that science comes from essentially public sources. And if the public is not necessarily, you know, in tune with what their science is doing for them, they're not going to value it as much. And, you know, in turn, we're not necessarily going to get as much funding towards those things, as opposed to, say, an app on your phone. The funding for that seems pretty straightforward because they directly interface with that technology, right? How can we take lessons from this one field and, again, bring it back to things that really matter and things that benefit society? And I love that you brought that up, because I think that's where your career is starting to sit now. And that's sort of where you're starting to exploit things a little bit more.
Yeah. And I'm seeing things in science that I think are really exciting. And I'm like, hey, if I can tell that story, if I can create a platform, if I can be one more voice to help get this information out or work within systems to be part of it. And things I'm learning as a Woman Tech Maker ambassador is that so many of our ambassadors are definitely at the top of the scale as far as women in tech, in terms of being leaders in their community, being active and being in mentorship. But we've been coming out of a leadership class, and we looked at, you know, there's strategic leadership, there's operational leadership. And every woman tech maker I've ever interfaced with, they have strategic and operational leadership. That's just part of who they are. They wouldn't have been applied to be a tech maker or been accepted to be a tech maker if they didn't have that. But where their growth is as a thought leader and as a bridge building leader. And I feel that this community is really creating an opportunity to lift up and help together this opportunity for us to have this collective voice.
Yeah, 100%. And I think a lot of the things that you mentioned and touched on so much lead into management as well. I see women tech makers and ambassadors as being amazing managers and potential leaders in the field, just because they understand, you know, bridging people and bridging technologies in a way that I think people who stay purely on the technical side sometimes struggle with, especially when it comes to building people up. I've had this weird up and down cycling relationship when it comes to my own, you know, intelligence and the way that I think about myself and where I find my place in technology. At first, I, you know, because I started very early on as a community organizer, for a really long time, I felt myself as just like a service. Like I exist solely for the community. And in a lot of ways, I ended up over-functioning. And, you know, everything that was asked of me, I just tried to meet at 110%. And I always gave other people that first platform. And I think, you know, obviously that goes into so much of, you know, our upbringings and how we think about ourselves and self-confidence, imposter syndrome. And eventually I did kind of reach this point where I did a 180 and I was like, you know what? No, my voice is worth being heard. And then I started speaking more and I started really becoming much more confident in myself and, you know, saying things that maybe I didn't think were the most intelligent, but I just thought, you know, I should say it anyways. And, you know, it's such an uncomfortable thing to come to now, but where I am is, you know, having to figure out the balance of where can I have room for myself and others, right? It's not always just one or the other. Where can I find that nuance where I can use that platform and, you know, as an extrovert, it's just the way that it is to bring introverts into the room and make sure that they're getting their platforms too. Same with other women, same with other people, because I think that I have a bit of privilege that I can use now to uplift other people. Whereas before, maybe I was just in a little bit more of a fight or flight mode, like, okay, I've just got to get in at all costs. I've got to kind of train roll through everybody and everything. And that has been my own personal journey. You know, where I sit now is, I chair a committee for a hackathon and it's a really big event that happens in my local community called the Vancouver Data Jam. And, you know, my leadership style from my first year of being a committee chair to now has been completely different, but almost, you know, exactly the same. My first year, I just took on everything. I didn't feel like I was worthy of asking my committee members to do things, of asking things of other people. I still struggle with asking for sponsorships, right? And I think that translates to so many other people's journey in tech with asking for salary raises or negotiating or even asking for fundraising, right? And then I kind of settled into this place of, okay, now I'm just going to offload everything to everybody because, you know, I've put in my dues and this is like other people's turn now to take the reins. And now it's like, how can I be a hands-on leader and not overfunction, but still also make it so that the people who are coming in, we can uplift and bring up their leadership skills at the same time? How can we create that bridge for them to then, you know, really feel comfortable and in their own? And it takes a little bit more care. It takes a little bit more nuance in your leadership style, but I think it's something that Women Tech Makers does really well. How can you empower and give somebody their own wings, but not necessarily feel like you're, you know, being patronizing or, you know, how do you find that balance in communication and how do you then ensure that it's trickled down to your managers that are working under you and they're building that philosophy to while keeping like a good environment. And it's so tricky sometimes.
Yes. And I think that we only see that obviously when we have these like, and you have deadlines and you have moving parts and you have budget and you have all these people and then we sort of show up as we are and we very quickly learn what we naturally do well, what we are kind of maybe naturally falling short on. And then there's the kind of the growing and the evolving, like how do we do this better? You mentioned sponsorships. It was interesting. Like that was actually one of my big wins when I first moved to Colorado was I just had that so dialed in and I got involved in some committees that they were like that they needed sponsorship chairs. And I jumped into that role and it was interesting because I did two that I just won at really, really well. And then the third one, they wanted to repeat one of them another year. And what they did is they sort of said, oh, you did such a great job last year. We're going to like raise the ask. And they kind of ignored the fact like that they gave me so much support the year before and that we had such a great team and it was really collaborative. And they'd have a new president every year. So the new president didn't understand any of the behind the scenes work that had went on. And the fact that I now had a whole punch list of things I would do differently now. And they had no interest in hearing any of those things or giving me any support team. And I sort of just started. And then I was like, I quit. No, I'm not doing this. And they were shocked. And I was like, yeah, because there's no way that you can succeed in this if you don't work collaboratively and you're not willing to improve and iterate the process. Because I learned everything we did right last year, but also saw the things we could have done better. But a big thing, just like a takeaway for you and anybody else, is that marketing departments have a budget. Think of it like you're not trying to plant a seed with somebody and say, hey, sponsor, you've never sponsored before. Like, we're going to grow this tree together. No, all you're doing is plucking the fruit. And so you just look for companies that you are solving a problem for them. They have marketing budget and then they have a purpose, which is we want to get in front of like this particular demographic. And, you know, and they usually want to like give away swag or do a demo or something that like you're helping them get market share, or they're really big. And it's just more like, hey, you want to be aligned and help your narrative be supporting the community. And this is a great place to show up and do this. So I think when you pitch for sponsorships, it's really making sure you have all the supporting documentation, because they always want to see it in writing. But the lead in is starting with, you know, do you have a marketing department? Do you have a marketing budget? They don't, like, they haven't, their fruit hasn't, is not ready to be plucked.
Yeah, I love that. And one of the two great pieces of advice to go into that as well, because I think that it's something that not a lot of data scientists understand, not a lot of software engineers understand as well when they're trying to do these community events, is all of the other parts of the organization. And, you know, at first I used to always pitch to DEI managers. And one of the best pieces of advice that I got from somebody else who, you know, kind of taught me so much about sponsorships has been, DEI budgets are low compared to marketing and recruiting. You need to learn how to resell yourself depending on which department that you're working with. And this goes into what you said. How can you solve the issue that particular department is going through, right? Recruitment for women in tech is an extremely hard thing. And, you know, if you can fix that problem by just giving them like, hey, here's 200 women who all of a sudden are qualified data scientists, like, doesn't that solve a problem that you're having as a recruiter? Doesn't that solve an HR problem that you're having with hiring if you're not getting enough applicants? Same with marketing as well. And I think one of the weird personal lessons that I had to deal with when trying to fundraise was not letting my own personal relationship with money cloud what looked like in tech. And I don't know if anybody else really deals with this, but like, I grew up without a lot of funds. I grew up thinking that like $5,000 was a ton of money. And it was a ton of money when I was growing up. And it still is. It still feels like a ton of money, right? But to a company, that's kind of not that much.
And
yeah. And I think a lot of women tech makers are so used to coming from underprivileged backgrounds that now they're thrusted into this position where they don't necessarily get the whole scope of things now. They don't see those numbers, right? Because they're not on that side. I think you get to see them because you have, like, you know, been around the block and you've seen corporations at this more holistic level. But a lot of data scientists and engineers don't really know that. And I think also we think of ourselves as sometimes being synonymous with our initiatives and what we do. And I oftentimes, you know, have to think, am I worthy of this investment from somebody? And I think that's such a thing that resonates with the community, because it affects the way that we lead. It affects our ability to do startups and to be executives. And it's so hard to grapple with that sometimes. But if you can separate that successfully and you can even compartmentalize it, because fixing it is going to take a lot of work and some years of growth in there as a person. But if you can successfully figure out, you know, how you can get a better, more realistic picture of your ass and how that relates to, you know, other places in the field, you're going to be much more successful, I think.
Yeah. And the other thing, it reminds me also when you go for example, scholarships or grants or things like that, they're listening exercises. They're not pitching exercises. You listen. And so a lot of times, again, if you have an idea of who the group of sponsors could be, before you have a deadline and a budget and like, oh no, I've got to figure out this problem, and then tomorrow. And, oh, I meant to call them 2 weeks ago, but now I'm calling them today. And then you're in pitch mode. The reality is, if you can find the point of contact like 6 months earlier and just say, what are you guys looking for? If I find an opportunity that would be a good fit, what would it look like? And ask and get the information and not trying to put it into your particular box. Now you have this information. There may be other people that you deal with or doing at the other events. And this, the answer that you got could be perfect for them. And now you're armed with this information. And then if yours is perfectly aligned, oh, it's a really, you're like said that you're not even, that fruit is just falling right in your hand. You're not even having to sort of pull it. But I think a lot of it is really getting in early and asking them, what kind of things do you guys sponsor? What kind of things are you guys looking for? If I come across one, what should I be bringing to you? What should I be recommending you for so that I can play matchmaker? And then, it, you know, I'd love it if my event was a perfect fit, but let me hear what you have to say first, because you have a budget. And that's another thing too about budgets. Budgets tend to be set year by year. And so they may not have planned for your event this year because they didn't know about it. They already kind of locked in their budget. But if they know about it and you can have an ongoing conversation, they can plan for it for the next year. They can pre-approve it. It's already in the budget. It's already planned for. It's not even like it has to be pulled out of a bigger undefined block of money. Like, you are now a line item. You're there. And so these were, you know, I think a big part of it is, like you said, relationship building is going in early and just asking it as a general point, because you kind of have an idea of the companies that you see that are floating out there that could be aligned and that you can get in and just build that relationship, find who's that point of contact, find out who's the right department. And it might take being referred to a few departments to get to the right person. That takes time. And if you are on a rush and you've got an event, you've got 100,000 other things on your to-do list, that's not going to be as much flow to it.
100%. And I think that's all just gold that you've given right there, especially to anybody who's like looking to figure out how to build relationships with sponsors. It's really that those small little pulses throughout the year that really pay off. And this is as somebody who has tried to fundraise very last minute and has kind of left the event planning last minute, because, you know, as women tech makers, we have full-time jobs, right? We are doing this as sort of this community service, and it can be really hard to figure out the allocation of that in terms of our time and in terms of our energy. But I do think that it really does pay off, because it gives you a fantastic network at the end, and you keep your kind of hands in this web, and it's a continuous thing that builds, and it really does snowball over time. And all of a sudden, you know, things become easier and easier, and you're then that company's or that sponsor's place to be connected with the community. And that centralized position is so powerful in a lot of ways, especially if you can get to that really trusting relationship. I really loved so much of what you said with, you know, taking your ego out of a problem, and instead of trying to prove yourself, really listening to a problem and what you can do to solve it and how you can be somebody's solution. Because I think in our careers in engineering, we are so caught up sometimes with proving that we're smart and that we belong, that we're not necessarily sitting down and listening. And I've been guilty of this throughout my career so many times of, you know, what are they actually trying to achieve? What do they need to make it to the next quarter if you're in a startup, right? Or what do they need to prove that this team works? And now as I interview with companies and you know, in the past, I've always really tried to gauge, you know, what is it that they're trying to solve and how can I help them? Or how can I figure out a way to help them instead of constantly proving I'm hireable, instead of constantly proving that I'm a good engineer and that my code is good. You know, if you can demonstrate that understanding of real problem solving, then I think you'll go so far in this field. And it's something that a lot of people don't necessarily learn until later. And in a lot of ways, it's what separates, you know, a junior from a senior, right? Is instead of being siloed in your own little code base, trying to perfect everything and pouring so much of yourself into it, thinking about the organization as a whole, you know, what is that ecosystem? What is that problem? What is that pain point? What is that bottleneck? And then tackling it. And it's not even about you. It's just about the solution that you're bringing to the table. You are just a tool in that sense.
And because you're a tool in that sense, one of the big things that I've been doing this year is I keep raising my hand. I raise my hand for the most ridiculous things now. And as long as I feel like there's a potential, they're aligned. It's not going to waste my time if I get it. But I don't care now if I don't get it, because I think the same thing about asking for a sponsorship. There's this sense of like, I need you to say yes. And you put so much energy into the building yourself up to even be able to ask that you kind of are so attached to a yes, where, mm-hmm. you know, to me, a lot of it also is like, yeah, here's the opportunity. Here's what it is. If it's a good fit for you, great. Let me know. Moving on. And it's just, and the idea that I can kind of put, and then a lot of the sponsorships I ended up getting, were people I had a friendly relationship with, and they were like, we like you. And, you know, we got an extra, you know, weren't big numbers, but they were like, we got an extra $500. We got an extra $2,000, and we're just going to give it to you because we like you. And sure, it's going to help our company, but it's not like, you know, a big thing for us that we expect like a big result from. It's not going to hurt our company, but we like you, and we're going to support the things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And I think that it's those relationships that feel much more organic and feel so much more genuine, right? When I think about our organizations and how we kind of started, at least for me, you know, being part of Women Tech Makers is fantastic, but it's this huge global organization. Where my heart is in my local community. That's where I started, was by volunteering at, you know, as a day camp leader and with my local, like, organizations, and then building my way up through there. And when you're interconnected within the community, it's all about just, hey, this person knows this person, or I've seen you like 3-4 times now at the same events. Let's just connect. Let's just be friendly. Let's just figure out where we're trying to go and if our interests align. And that is something that now in sort of this COVID age, as things have moved remotely, in a lot of ways we've lost. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. I'm very lucky in that I live in a city where there is a tech community, and I can just kind of go outside my door and there's 5 different meetup groups there. And that is so nice. But also when things are online completely and things are moving at this global scale or this national scale, it can feel really hard to build those same relationships that then lead to these sort of organic sponsorships in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was about personal relationships. And I think it, like other things that I have, because I've moved a couple cities, is like, what makes you feel safe? And I feel that when the people you know each other, and what makes people motivated to want to know you is when they know that you know people that they know. And mm-hmm. I think that that's that idea of community and being able to show up regularly and contribute. But I have sometimes such a light touch in communities, but because I'm there for such a long period of time and they know me, that I can pop in and out, and it's like I never left. And it's always, I feel welcome, always feel safe, always feel that that network has been going on without me and continues to only get stronger. And then they all know I'm part of it, so I can sort of pop in when I do. And I think people have talked about you know, sort of the older you get, the harder it is to make friendships. And I always feel like just, again, finding communities you're really aligned with is, and where the people know that you know each other and that you're really part of a fabric, is a great way to build those friendships when you're older. Another thing that you were sort of saying, which reminded me, I have this new, I kind of got it at the conference, where I've been feeling this really strong sense of ageism in the fact that I'm mid-career. I walked away from what I was doing before, and I was like, I'm kind of starting over, and then not at the same time, because those past relationships and those past experience are kind of coming to the fore. And it's my version of ageism, which is to say, I don't care how you judge me, I'm judging you. When I look at a company and a culture, I have way higher standards than I've ever had before about what the work I'm willing to do, how I'm willing to be managed, how I want to be compensated, where I work, how I work. And that's just not something I ever thought about before. And so yeah, I take that as a positive thing.
It's a tricky situation. I think as women in tech, we know that there is this intersectionality between these gender roles oftentimes that are put upon us by society. And, you know, so one of the event that I run, which is the Vancouver Data Jam, we do workshops and we're very beginner friendly. And one of the nice things about this hackathon is that we target working professionals. We're not just, you know, based around university students. I think so many hackathons are kind of around that ecosystem. We don't need to concentrate on it anymore. And so oftentimes, because of the way that we market ourselves too, we get a lot of women who are returning to their careers after a break, who are switching from more non-technical fields to then become, you know, data professionals. And that's always one of the big questions is, you know, I've heard it like maybe 3-4 times now at this point in the last 3 months, you know, I'm coming back after a break. I am, you know, over 40 at this point. Everywhere that I'm interviewing is just turning me down based off this career break and this ageism. You know, can you help me, right? And in a lot of ways, it's like, yes, I can get you into these classes and you can, you know, attend these workshops and you can build these connections. But there's a weird reality there of, you know, cognitive dissonance between, you know, this bias that we have. But also, I think that there's an empowerment too. And I speak as somebody who doesn't have to deal with these issues. So I kind of acknowledge that I can say it, but I haven't had to live through it. And I think that's something that's worth acknowledging on my side. And I think it's something that we all fear as women in a lot of ways. But there's an empowerment to going, you know what? Screw you guys. I didn't want to work here anyways. I'm going to go do my own thing. And we're in the ecosystem where we can do that now, where maybe 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. But now you can start your own consultancy if you want to. You don't need to be the next, you know, big IPO. You just need to make enough to live. And I think a lot of people are happy with that. And not to say that you should keep the bar low, but there's options now that exist where you now no longer have to bend over backwards just to please somebody who didn't like you to begin with anyways. And that's where we're seeing a lot of these really unique and cool startup ideas come from. And that grit that you have, that perseverance can pay off so well, especially if you're willing to do things like, you know, learn continuously and get back in touch with the community and put yourself out there. I think that's probably the initial hardest step is being vulnerable in that sense.
Yeah. And that was, you know, things that I had to kind of address, and the fact that when I lived in the heart of Los Angeles, there were probably millions of jobs available to me, a very short commute in, or, you know, it's LA. And then over time, as I had jobs, I'd move from one side of the city to another. And some of it was driven by work and some of it was just driven by sort of personal choice. But either way, I was like, I was in the heart of the city and I never thought about the idea that a job would not be readily available to me because there were just so many things to do and there were so many opportunities. And then I moved to Denver and then sort of found myself kind of gravitating towards Boulder, which is about 45 minutes northwest of Denver, but had really kind of tight communities. And the part of the reason I've sort of done a reset on my career is that when I got there very quickly, there was a whole wash over of the cannabis and CBD industry. So I found myself working in the cannabis and CBD industry. And there were tons of startups that needed a lot of marketing. I still did a lot of work with law firms, HOAs, construction, because there were a lot of stuff happening there. But ultimately, I just found myself completely sort of pulled into the cannabis industry. And then after a while, there was a number of reasons why I was like, it was led by personal when my marriage ended and I was like, went back to kind of hang out with my family back east. And then my mom's actually in California. And so I have my family split across the country. My parents are in their mid-80s. And I was realizing they needed a lot more attention. So I've never been in the role of a caregiver before. And now I am. And so now I think about the fact that, like, my dad lives in rural Pennsylvania. My mom lives in closer to San Diego. So it's like there's opportunities there. But they're very fixed. Like, in my younger days, like, I would have just moved right next. I don't like commuting. I would have moved right next door to the company, you know, got an apartment. Like, I didn't even have thought about the fact that, you know, now I'm like, no, I'm in a very fixed location. Like, I can't just move next door. I could hang out with you guys. I could get a hotel, a long-term stay for like a month or two, or even like, I could probably have done that even maybe 6 months or a year ago. Now my mom's like almost at full-time care. Like, I can't even go back to Pennsylvania right now. So I'm like, how does this work? And I'm thinking it, but I'm not thinking it. I think that's why I've decided. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to lean into the being as technically proficient as I can be with all the things I'm super passionate about, which is like spatial data science. I like want to be very good. I can work on teams. I can travel. I'm sure we can sort of get her, you know, paid care as she goes. I mean, but it's striking that balance that I've never had before. I was like, how do I do this? And I think it's got made me a lot more motivated to be a content creator because I can say like, okay, I can see that there's a path there. But also I'm like, I still need health insurance. I get it through my university. I've got another 18 months of school. So like, there's no rush, but it's for the first time in my life. Like, I actually have to think about these things in a way I've never had to think about them before.
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned this, and this was not something that I was planning to bring up whatsoever, but I think as a woman tech maker, it's one of my more defining features where like for like about 3 years, I was a caregiver as an only child to like an only parent. And, you know, during that time, all I can think about was how much I was ruining my career. Maybe not all I could think about, but it was one of the big things because I was a workaholic. I couldn't move for any sort of internships or early career opportunities. And I was fixed in this place. And, you know, all your time, all your energy is being poured into this one thing. And, you know, caregiver burnout is so real. And I was just talking to another software engineer who I was providing some mentorship for, who was dealing with the same thing, right? She was like, oh my God, I'm 25 and I'm a caretaker. How did you do this? It's only been 5 months for me. And it's one of those things where you have to learn at that point which decisions are worth making and which aren't. And it's one of the biggest life lessons that I've had to personally go through. But it was that experience that I think makes me such a good leader in the community now. Because I think when people talk to me, they kind of get that sense of like, genuineness, because I really don't muck around now. It's like, how severe is this issue? Let's, you know, really figure out the pros and cons of this, and let's figure out the life nebulous stuff around that. That's something that should be acknowledged, and I think that's something that, you know, Woman Tech Makers does, right? But it was really hard at that point, and in a lot of ways, even now, I feel like I'm still having to bounce back technically from my career, and at the time, you're dealing with so much stuff. Like, it's just like hell sometimes. And, you know, the last thing that you're thinking about is like, oh, I should go learn Kubernetes, right? Because you're just like trying to make it through the day sometimes and you're exhausted. And now I'm in a place where I can think about those things. But, you know, and the reason why I bring this up is because I felt like it was this sinkhole and waste of time that I just lost, you know, my early to mid 20s. Like just doing this thing. And now as I'm a little bit older and now, you know, as I've had time back in the industry, it's like, you know what, that maturity, that ability to think really strategically and to think about these really deep things and take them head on, they're so valuable. And I think they reach, you know, different parts of our careers in ways that we don't necessarily even have the ability to acknowledge or see, because it becomes so integral to who we are as people. And weirdly enough, I think other people can sense it and they can also acknowledge it in their own ways, but it's so hard when you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. And I mine's like a day by day like thing. It was, cause I was actually planning on even going to Colorado this October. And I reached out to my friend that I stay with there. And I was like, you know, I can't leave right now. I said, and it's she's fine 98% of the time, but it's the 2% I worry about. It's the, you know, yeah. It's like, she doesn't take her medicine by herself. I, you know, I administer that every day. Super simple thing, takes 5 minutes. I mean, my mom and I get along so well. She's super easy to live with. She knows I'm in grad school. She knows I'm like, she refers to it as, oh, you're clacking, or I have my studio time. And she's very supportive of, so I don't feel yet that I'm like, I've held back from all the learning I want to do, from all the connecting I want to do. I have a couple trips to LA, day trips, like no problem. But going away for 2 days, 3 days, like that's where I, you know, so I'm now like, okay, I have to like accept this new reality. And yeah, so it's I think, but I mean, women with kids, women with husbands, women with houses. And if those houses aren't, you know, in an urban environment, you limit your options. And so it's trying to figure out kind of, I think all of these things just need to be sorted out both individually and collectively. Because I'm sure I'm not the only one. And and as at the same time, like, well, what's the other option? I'm at the point where I'm like, I'd rather keep her alive and make certain sacrifices than the alternative. But I also understand, like, when the alternative happens, you know, I will be set free to go do other adventures. And given my interest in disaster resilience and recovery, you know, I'm very likely to just show up, you know, in a disaster and get my hands dirty and see what I can actually do. So there, I know that this time is also very finite and I want to appreciate it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as people, I think we grow so much from it. Like I had to make the same decision. I set my career on fire for like 3 years straight, where I was just cycling through different startups at a certain point. And in a lot of ways, I was underperforming. But it also allowed me to see which companies were really worth sticking with and which weren't, who was understanding and who wasn't. And I think a lot of times when we first enter into the industry, all we can think about again is proving ourselves. And we're not necessarily critical of, what's around us or the company. We just want to get hired. We just want to be a software engineer. In a lot of ways, we're just chasing that title to validate ourselves in some way, validate our intelligence. But, after a certain point when all of these other things come into play, you then really take a look at things with a more critical eye. And I think that makes you a more realistic person. It makes you somebody who stands on your own a lot better. And it's not pretty, but it's worth it to do in the end. And it's a lesson that I think so many people have to learn, because we all deal with things through life. Like, it's just something that is inevitable. We have partners that, go through things as well. We have kids that get sick. We have parents that eventually die. We, who knows, right? There's so much. Our homes get set on fire sometimes. Hell, half the country is burning right now, and that's just something that we're supposed to ignore at work. It's totally not realistic. It's not going to happen. And the more transparent and open that we are about these things, I think the more change we can push in the industry, because our industry is one that is high performing, especially if you're in the startup arena. You're given like 50, 60 hours a week, and you're doing all this community work on the side, and then you're dealing with this nebulous life stuff. It's crazy. Like, it really is crazy. And in a lot of ways, you're just kind of pushing through it, but in some other ways, you're just figuring out what can be on fire and what can't be. What trade-offs am I going to make? And that's something that only you can make as a person. Nobody can judge you for those things, because only you know the whole picture.
Yep. And it, I think the thing is that women are doing an incredible job of still stepping into what is a man's world. What are these structures? Everything from the 9 to 5, even that was, a lot of labor movements had to sort of make it so that it wasn't the 12-hour day and the 7-day work week and the 6-day work week. And, we've gotten it to where we have it. But I think as we get more women leaders, we're going to actually see workplace cultures evolve. I remember being in one office where they were being very protective of the moms. And so if you had kids and you needed anything, they were like, oh, no problem. But that wasn't fair for the rest of us who didn't have kids. Like, I wasn't allowed to, even if I felt like I'd be more creative and productive, to go downstairs and work in the coffee shop, couldn't leave my desk. And yet if someone was like, oh, I have kids, I'm gonna work from home this afternoon, oh, no problem. And I was like, so I also feel like that way, I truly feel like to get the gender equality we're looking for is to actually give the same flexibility to men, and that they evolve to be able to sort of pick up more of the home responsibilities and the home duties that they're right now, many of them are sort of completely off the hook for outside of some yard work and some grilling. So we need to like also sort of evolve our society so that women don't feel like they're just doing two full-time jobs.
Yeah, I think pat leave is something that, as more countries adopt it and as it gets supported and accepted so much more, I think it's going to be, fantastic. Like, I think it's really going to help people at home. And now we're reaching this point where, unfortunately, due to the cost of living, you have both parents having to work. I don't think people are really able to live off just one salary anymore. And with that comes so many different questions of who's going to take on what. It's just not feasible for one person to do both roles anymore. If you have two people in the household, there's going to have to be a split of things anyways. That's just the way that it is. It's unfair otherwise. And, sometimes that doesn't necessarily have to look like you do dishes every single, Wednesday and Tuesday, Thursday. But instead it looks like, okay, a couple years we're going to focus on your career and I'll take on the brunt. A couple years we're going to trade it off, and there's so many different lifestyles out there these days that, people can really move at their own pace. It's just the acceptance of the people around them that can be a setback sometimes. And hopefully, we can push through that, which is what I'm hoping for as well. You know, there are a lot of amazing men out there who would be great fathers, but we then kind of stigmatize it in our society sometimes, unfortunately amongst other men as well, right? And I think that's something that needs to be addressed directly. You know, women's issues are men's issues and men's issues are women's issues, right? The pressure that one gender feels oftentimes can be alleviated through the other gender. And that's something that we need to look at really holistically. Again, it's bringing this very like engineering perspective to relationships and to life, where it's just like, you know, how can we postmortem this in a blameless way and just bring in a solution without really thinking about the identity politics around it? Because yeah, that's just what we want, is a solution at the end. It's not to bring an ego. It's not to feel power, even if it might be tempting to bring that in sometimes.
Yeah. And I say it that just from a point of view of, you know, as I'm doing more in the intelligence community, I just joined an organization. I was part of a women's networking like happy hour that online, and a lot of the women were saying like that the men aren't running the kids to the doctor's appointments. And so, and then I was also doing an Air Force recruitment thing where women were like, oh, well, we're treated completely equally at the office. It's like, yes, but you're not treated equally at home. And this is the problem. And so it's great that there's sort of this perceived gender equality where women are getting all these same promotional opportunities as men, and they're sort of narrowing those pay gaps. But to make it so that when a man says, hey, I got to leave today because I got to pick up my kid from school today, that's normalized,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll pick up, finish whatever I need to do, or I'll come in early, you know, that men get a much flexibility, or I got to leave this afternoon because I got to be the one taking the kids to the doctor, whatever it is, like that sort of gender parity, I think, is that next level. We're not there yet.
Yeah. And I think that also can lead into more granular things in the workplace too, of not just having more women leaders, but also having more male leaders who are capable of emotional labor and, you know, really mentorship in the same way that we expect women to. I some of my best mentors have been men in the field who have really uplifted me. Some of my worst mentors have also been men in the field who have put me down and who have really said some nasty things to me. And I find that when we're able to distribute, you know, expectations a little bit more evenly, instead of just like flocking to the first female leader that we see and expecting her to take on the emotional labor of everybody who's a female in the workplace, like that's just a ridiculous expectation to have too. And, when I first started Data Jam, one of the things that was most magical about it was that we were five women doing this grassroots organization. I think people loved that we were an all like woman committee. And then as the years went by, we introduced more men into our committee, but still kept the mandate of, you know, being like a women's based event. And I think a lot of like initial pushback to that was, you know, well, it's so magical to have all women in your community, but it's like, well, we're draining the community if we're only taking the female leaders that are in there and then forcing them to do this extra like 10 hours of work per week. Like if there's men who want to contribute and who are capable of doing it and who share the vision, let them be part of it. Like why would I turn down the help? And it, you know, how can we reward and incentivize that in the same way? There's an awareness too. I think a lot of us as women tech makers or who are women software engineers, we deal with either being in fully, you know, women tech groups, where I think it's a very specifically designated safe place, and being the only woman in a male space, right? I have two different groups in that sense who are tech focused. There's my women's coding groups, and then there's me hanging out at a bar with my friends who are all men. And it's like, why do I have this expectation of safety and comfort and emotional labor in one environment, but not the other? And how can I bring more awareness into the other and bring that sort of, you know, advocacy in a way that then creates a safer environment between the both of them, right? It's a tricky position to be in sometimes, but that's just kind of the reality of also being a woman tech maker, is not really, you know, always being in women's spaces, but also acknowledging that 99% of the time we're in men's spaces as well.
Yep. Yeah. And so those are all things that are important to talk about, and I'm glad that we're talking about them here. This has been excellent. Thank you so much. Let me just have you sort of wrap up some sort of final words.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed being part of this journey. We've talked about so many different topics. My last piece of advice to anybody listening to this is just to kind of embrace the journey. You know, I think, you know, you've really said it best, and I've kind of designated it as well, where there's so many different facets of your life that come into play late game that you don't necessarily think about during the journey. And, you know, you might think that something is a waste of time, like, or just like the side thing that won't come into play, but it really does make a difference later. And you might not necessarily see it, but trust that it will come together. And if not that, then trust that you will make it come together in some way. And that's a really beautiful thing to trust yourself.